This is The Loving Project, a podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court decision that legalized interracial marriage across the United States.
In each episode, we hear from a different couple about what it's like to be in an interracial marriage today. This time we hear from David and Belinda. David is white and grew up in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Belinda is black and grew up in Pleasantville, New Jersey, where the couple now lives.
They've been together since the early 1980s. When they met, David had two daughters, and Belinda was raising her own daughter, who was younger, and who David eventually adopted. The couple got married less than two decades after the Supreme Court issued its landmark ruling in the case of Loving v. Virginia.
1967 is the year that I graduated from high school. It does not seem like that long ago. It is absurd to me that it took that long for us as a nation to recognize that. It's almost immoral that we would have to litigate love and marriage. And I'm saying this for any two people that love one another, whether we're talking about gay marriage, whether we're talking about interracial marriages. My heart breaks when I think about what the Loving family went through. And my heart breaks when I think about what gay couples go through now in just trying to be with somebody that you love.
I think for me, back in 67, I wasn't even aware that it was illegal for interracial couples to marry. I knew that didn't happen. I was aware of the Jim Crow era in the South and all of what was going on. But I never even heard of that ruling until, probably within the last 5 years or so. But as Belinda said, how can that be legislated? And I know a lot of bad stuff has been legislated, and we're still trying to deal with that. Belinda was much more articulate than I am on these issues, but I'm sure glad it happened. My name is David, and I'm white.
My name is Belinda, and I'm black.
And we were married on New Year's Eve, 1986.
And we have three daughters and four grandchildren.
I used to ride my bike to work, and I remember riding home one day, and a black woman in a big yellow car coming in the opposite direction waved at me with a real big smile. And I thought to myself, who the heck is that? I don't know who that is. And I rode home puzzling about that for many years.
I used to drop my daughter off at preschool, and I'm a creature of habit, and I never have the correct time on my clock in my car. So I don't really keep track of time like most people do, but I do it by what's happening outside of the environment. David is a creature of habit also, in terms of how he rides his bicycle. So I would be able to tell where I saw this man on his bicycle. I could be able to tell whether I was running late for work or whether I was on time. So it became a thing for me seeing this guy on his bicycle, which is why I started waving at him. But I wasn't thinking about, number one, I wasn't thinking about meeting him, number one. And number two, I definitely wasn't thinking about having a relationship with him. And number three, Lord knows I wasn't thinking about marrying him. You know, that just all was, I guess, the way the universe works.
Yes.
We just don't know what's going to happen.
And then one September, I went to a workshop the company that I work for was giving. And at the first break, black woman comes up to me and says, "Hi, I'm Belinda. Do you ride your bike to work?" I said, "Yeah, I do." She said, "I see you on Broad Street in Pleasantville." I said, "Really?" I said, "Well, what kind of a car do you drive?" She said, it's a red Datsun. And I said, "Oh, well, I'll be on the lookout for you." And then occasionally I would see her and I'd wave because, you know, I wave to folks that wave back to me. It wasn't until after we were married that I learned that she had a yellow Pontiac, and she was the one that had waved to me many years ago as I was riding my bike home. I said, "Wow, I never," because when she waved at me, she had long hair and she had it permed and all of that. When I met her at that point, she had it cut short, so she looked totally different to me, but it was the same person, just in a different car.
You know, I meet people and I'm not really planning on engaging in a relationship with them. And I don't think he was either initially, but he used to drop by my desk and he used to leave cards.
Yeah, we worked in different locations.
Completely different locations. And he'd drop by my desk and he'd leave his little business card and, you know, hello, how are you? And I'm like, you know, this white guy's stalking me and I'm not cool with that. And I wasn't interested in a relationship at the time because I was focusing on my kid and dealing with my life. And I describe where I was at that time in my life as having kissed a number of frogs, thinking that they were going to be a prince. And I wasn't interested in meeting any more frogs. And he didn't even look like a frog at the time. So I rejected that as a possibility in my life. Until it was a winter night. It was ice. It was snowing. It was horrible. And a friend of mine and I decided to take our children to the Hamilton Mall. Shore Mall. We're walking through the Shore Mall. And I had told her about David. And, you know, by then he was an interesting guy. He's interesting, but he's a white guy. And we're walking through the mall with our kids. And there he is sitting on the bench. And I said to Tony, my friend, that's the guy from work. And she said, really? I said, yeah, that's the guy. And he comes over. And he starts talking and he says, do you want to go to the movies? And I'm like,
What?
I don't think so. You know, I've got my kid here and I'm here with friends and no, I don't think I'm, no. So we continue down the mall and my friend Tony said, girl, you crazy. Why don't you just go to the movies with him? And I said, I don't know, Tony. She said, I'll take Phoenix home. So I said, okay. So I had to go home and get Phoenix's clothes, take her out to Tony's, and then come back to the mall. And it took me a while to do that.
What I had done in the meantime was walk across from the mall to where the theater was, which was across the parking lot, and it was cold, and I didn't really have a heavy coat on. But anyway, I went in the lobby.
Camel hair's jacket.
Yeah, it was.
And gloves, and that's all you had on.
So I sat in the lobby, you know, and I'm looking at my watch and half hour, 40 minutes. I said, damn, I think I got stood up here. I sat there and it's getting closer to the start time for the feature. And finally she walked through the door and I said, wow, she came. And we went to see the movie and it was fantastic. The turning point was the movie and later on, I invited her over to my work area, which is in the technical world, and gave her the tour of the shop where I worked. And, you know, she did the obligatory, oh, yeah, isn't that interesting? Because tech stuff is not her thing.
Right over my head.
But she feigned interest, and that was endearing, too. So it kind of grew from there. One of the things that I learned later that in your earlier days you would have said, there's no way I would marry a white guy.
Exactly. Yeah. I grew up during the 60s, and I was a pretty radical person at that time. And with the emergence of Facebook, I've had friends who have said to other friends, you know, when they see David in my picture, they'll say, who's that white guy with Belinda? Because they still remember who I was, and I would never have married a white man. And my friends who have been with me for the journey with David say, oh, that's not a white guy, that's David. And so that's who he has become to my friends and my family. We talk about ourselves as a balanced couple. Not an interracial couple, but a balanced couple. He's the yin to my yang. David is a very reserved person. He's very quiet, as you've noticed. I'm the talker. David is also a very detailed person, and he's very organized. And I'm quite the opposite. I explode and have art forms all over the place.
That's what I call piles of stuff.
That's what he calls my piles of stuff, right? And my husband dates everything from light bulbs to the clothes that he wears.
Got to know how long they last.
That's my husband, you know? And it took me a while to like, you really do that? But I know that I can go to him and I can ask him, what's the best light bulb to buy? What's going to last the longest?
She had sunglasses, which she lost, and she wanted to get another pair. So she came over the other day and said, do you know if I have a prescription for my sunglasses?
Yeah.
And I had two of them. One's dated 2013, one's dated 2014, which I knew right where it was. And
pulled it right out.
And she said, well, thank you very much.
Right. And I went and got my eyeglasses.
Yes, you did.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we work well together, and that's the balance, or part of the balance anyway.
Yeah. And I watch people in relationships that appear to have a lot more in common. I mean, black folk relationships, and white folk relationships, and Latino, whatever. And I watch them bickering, and they yell at each other, and we've never had that. We've never had that. I don't know what it is that makes it that way, but sometimes we agree to disagree, but it doesn't change anything.
I grew up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in the 40s and 50s, which at the time was probably 98% white. And until I got to high school, I never saw a black kid. And in our graduating class of 860-some, there might have been 15 black kids. And I didn't really know any of them. So I was pretty much totally enveloped in the white world and enjoying the white privilege that we white folks enjoy. And meeting Belinda and learning about the African-American stories was a whole new learning for me, a whole revelation. It's been a wonderful journey.
I went to an HBCU, historically black university, Hampton Institute, after having grown up in a predominantly white community. When I grew up here in Pleasantville, it was a predominantly white community. And there were very few African Americans in my class. It kind of mirrored David's, but it was just a smaller environment. My senior year in high school, all of the white students were having their interviews with the guidance counselor. And I hadn't been called up to have an interview. And I didn't know everybody else was having an interview with the guidance counselor. So when I found out that they were, and that they were filling out college applications, I took myself to the guidance office. And a friend of mine had told me where all the catalogs were. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But I picked a blue one, because I like blue. And the only blue one that was there was the one for Hampton Institute. I didn't even know anything about Hampton Institute. But that was the only college I applied to, and I got accepted. But I'll tell you this, when I drove up on that campus, I thought I had died and gone to heaven, because it was nothing but a sea of black folks. I'd never been to a prom. I'd never been on a date before that time. But it was not as cool as I thought, because I was still different, because I didn't have the same background as most of the African-American students there who had gone to black schools, you know, and they were cool. I mean, and I was listening to the Beatles. I had my guitar and I had a Mary Poppins bedspread. You know, I was a different kind of person, but I caught up real quick. And those were also the days of riots on campuses and takeovers and all of those kinds of things. And so I became a part of that kind of movement and ended up being put on social probation. And I was supposed to be out of school for a semester. I was out for a year because what I decided to do was to go south, and I went to New Orleans. That was really an eye-opener. I became a part of Black Art South and Freedom Theater and watched attempts to desegregate shoe stores and traveled to Freedom House in Jackson, Mississippi. And so all of those experiences were a part of who I was. My cousin was a part of the Black Panther Party, and we went to her home in Baltimore. And my experience of being black in America did not lend itself to accepting the ability to bridge that gap to marry a white guy. When he first asked me to marry him, I was like, you know, the dating is one thing, you know, and I do love you, but I don't know. You know, I know this man, but I don't know this man, living with this man. You know what I mean? And I've got a little black girl, you know? And I think that that little black girl was a key piece for me. When we got married, she was 7 years old. And how she's going to be understood, how she's going to be able to understand this relationship. I also didn't know, I knew he loved me, but I didn't know if he loved her. And I had to learn that he loved her. And like I said, my husband is sweet and a little naive in terms of, you know, what the potential of a lot of those things could be. So I was a little bit more apprehensive, I think, than he was.
Yeah, I wasn't apprehensive at all.
I know you weren't. He was like, I don't understand what the problem is. I don't get it. I loved him, you know? I loved him. And you get to the point where you just say, let's do it, you know? Let's just go ahead and do it. And there's never been a time in the 30-plus years where I would ever think of walking away from it.
Me either.
David had an uncle that lived in
Mount Gretna,
Pennsylvania. Beautiful, beautiful area. And I remember going out to the front porch, and hanging on the front porch was a Confederate flag. And there was a visceral gut kind of punch to me because I knew what that meant. I knew what that meant. I think David, in many ways, was very naive.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, so he didn't think about a lot of those things. And
yeah, I didn't think about what that really meant.
Right.
And we all went to a local eatery, and my uncle went up to the proprietor and said, I'm here with a colored girl. Do you have any problem with that? She looked over and said, as long as she got money, I don't care. That's the last we went back to visit. To me, that was just outrageous. And yet I didn't say anything to him, which I should have, but I didn't. I learned from my only cousin on that side later on, in fact, in the last few years, how racist my father's generation was. I didn't really know that at the time. My cousin's father, who was the oldest of four brothers, went to a Lena Horne concert, and he was ostracized from the family as being a traitor. And I never knew that. And as I think back about some of my parents' comments, I can see that now. I didn't recognize it at the time. And my uncle was probably the most overtly racist person. On my mother's side, by the time we were married, there were only two aunts and an uncle alive. And they were all very accepting of us. So it's been good. And I don't really have a lot of contact with my family because they're all far away. And, you know, a couple of them are friends on Facebook. And based on the comments of some of my cousin's children, I can say, they're a little on the racist side. And I may be making too much of that, but that's my sense of it.
My father is a person, or was a person, who loved people. He was just a wonderful man in that way, and open to embracing anybody and everybody. My mother, she was protective to the point of when any of us brought anyone home. She needed to know who you were, who your people were, everything down to the back molars of your teeth. And she wanted nothing to do with you until she was clear about all of that and the fact that you were not going to harm her kids. And she was very serious about that.
Yes, she was.
She was very serious about
that. She was tough.
She was tough. But once she committed to you, she was committed to you. Once she knew And it really didn't even happen when we got married.
No, it didn't.
It didn't happen until well after we were married that she accepted this man, because she know him. She know his people. She know where he came from. She didn't know nothing about this man. But the rest of my family, you know, well, David's just to be loved. But the rest of the family was fine. My mother was the most difficult, because that's just who she was.
Yeah, and hearing the stories from other spouses, they went through the same ordeal. I didn't take it personally, and I heard that, you know, well, it's not you, David, it's everybody.
Right. Even with my brothers, and they were marrying women, you know what I mean? So for me to marry as a female, and I have a sister, and her husband went through the same thing. Though I don't think Rick ever got.
No.
He never got.
He was never in.
He was never in.
He was never in.
And he's black. Okay? David has two biological daughters, and I have one biological daughter. David's daughters are the older of the two.
Oldest is Melinda. The younger of the two is Laura.
But Phoenix is the youngest of all of them, and that is my daughter, my biological daughter. David has adopted Phoenix. I never adopted his daughters because they were older and their mother is living. But together we have three children.
Our youngest daughter, Phoenix, and I, when she was in college, were driving through Linwood, which is predominantly white, was even more so 10 years ago. And I was ahead of her in my truck. She was behind me in her car. And a Linwood cop comes the opposite way, does a U-turn, and pulls her over. And I said to myself, I wonder what that's about. I mean, I know her license was current. I know all her taillights are working because I took care of that. So I pulled over and I, you know, he's into the license and registration kind of stuff. And I said, excuse me, officer, why are you stopping my daughter? And he looked quite puzzled at me. And he said, well, nothing really. Everything's okay. You can go. Now, to me, that was white privilege at two levels. Number one, he didn't pull me over. He pulled Phoenix over. And because I was white, she was okay, which is another form of white privilege. So, you know, that's how I've benefited from it. And when I walk around in a store, and someone will come, you know, a clerk will say, you know, can I help you find something? No, I'm fine. And they go away. They don't hang by and try to tidy up the shelves. And Phoenix has experienced that numerous times because she's black.
When the Friend School closed here, we had to find a place for our daughter to go to school. And public schools were really atrocious. So in looking around, we decided that we would put her in a Catholic school. We had heard it was a good school. And one day we get a phone call. I get a phone call at work to please come to the school that they were going to suspend her, which is like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, of all of our kids, our three kids, this one would not be the one that would be suspended. So we get there, and what had happened was one of the nuns had stopped another child outside of the classroom and was admonishing them about something. And Phoenix said, take the fifth, tell them to call your mother. Because that was always one of the things I instructed her to do when an adult confronts you and you know you've done nothing wrong. Don't get in an argument with them. Just ask them to call your mother. Now, by this time, this was her second year there, we had told other black parents who had had kids at Friend School that, you know, this seemed to be a pretty good school. So there were other kids there now. So anyhow, they're going to suspend her. And the head nun says, and while we're here, and I'm saying, you're going to suspend her for that, you know. Well, that's not the only thing that's happened. While we were in the library working, we were standing behind the stacks and the children were having a conversation. And we heard Phoenix talking, and she sounded just like one of them. And I said, what do you mean by that? She says, well, you know, the problem is I think that she may be schizophrenic. She said, you know, she was dropping her R's and, you know, she was really talking strangely. And I said, are you aware of who she is? They didn't know that Phoenix was not biologically David's child. And so she shouldn't be speaking like this. because her dad's white. And so all of the things that they hang on black children don't get hung on her. And when they do, it's because she must be schizophrenic. And we had to have some conversation with her about who, what you're looking at is a little black girl. And what you're looking at is a girl who is bilingual. And she has to be by nature of who she is. And that schizophrenia is a medical diagnosis and you're not qualified to make it anyway. So we did have those kinds of things. And she did have incidents where kids would say to her, you know, oh, you know, you got a white daddy kind of thing. And she would say, I put my white daddy up against your black daddy any day in terms of who knows more about African-American history, because he probably does. I should say, too, my father played in the Negro Leagues. So there is that history that exists in my family that he's had black cliff notes for the past few years, you know, and he has learned a lot, I think. And I think both of us have expanded our, I have grown more understanding and sympathetic of the white experience and understanding that all white folks don't act the way they do just because they want to. You know what I mean? Like his lack of knowledge about everything from the cultural experience of black folks taking home a plate, you know, that is really not impolite, to how you respond to a Confederate flag. He just didn't know. He just didn't know, you know, which doesn't make him any less of the wonderful human being that he is. We laugh about things now when we're at someone's home and somebody says, aren't you going to take home a plate? Or let me fix a plate to take home. And we can laugh about it because now we can talk about the differences in how we experience that and how funny it is, because it is funny. You know, and I never thought about, you know, it kind of can be a little bit tacky. You know what I mean? When you think about it, you know, but it's just what we do. We always have extra food. Like my mother.
Just say, speaking of extra food.
Right.
In my world, at Thanksgiving, we'll say, there was a turkey and there were vegetables and there were mashed potatoes and there might be yams. So that's what I expected. You know, Easter was a ham. I remember the first time I went to Belinda's family Thanksgiving, and there was a turkey, there was a roast beef, there was a ham, there were greens.
Macaroni and cheese.
Macaroni and cheese.
Sweet potatoes.
There were sweet potatoes. You know, my jaw dropped. I just wasn't used to this. It was an eye-opener for me as far as how black folks celebrate, how the Manning family celebrates holidays. I mean, it still amazes me.
And part of that is my mother used to save all of her food money. My grandmother did the same thing for holidays. Between September and November, you ate very austere because they were saving the money for the holidays. Because the holidays, everybody comes and you have a lot of food because people are taking home a plate. You know, even if you're not eating it, folks are taking home food. That's just what we do. And I think that that harpens back to, historically, the nature of people coming together to share what it is they had and making sure that there was still some for people to take home so that they could enjoy it for the rest of the week. But that was not his experience.
At all.
At all.
At all.
At all.
And, you know, like Belinda said, folks would stop by and, you know, they'd take a plate of food and there was always enough. Never ran out. And that was just so foreign for me. My parents were Depression era folks. They were German heritage, so pretty austere. And there was never the lavish feasts that I experienced in the Manning family. It's wonderful.
The one sense of not enough is that you have to hold it for yourself. And the other sense of not enough is that you have to compile it together so that everybody has something. But it's a different way of experiencing scarcity. And I think that the African-American experience historically has been one of learning to bind for the good of the whole. So it's a different way of experiencing how we are able to exist in the world. I think our entry into the Black Lives Matter movement was interesting because the entry into that was initiated by my husband. And the leadership role that was taken in Black Lives Matter in this community as it relates to us was taken by him. I think that it is unusual for that to be the case, that a white man would do that, because I thought about it and I said, you know, this looks interesting. But it was his initiative that got us up and out of the house and to the meetings. It was his initiative that did the emails and stayed in contact with folks and volunteered to do the presentations and all of that. I would exercise my feelings about what was going on as it relates to Black lives through clay or poetry, you know? But he was more active in terms of being active in the community around those things. He's more active in NAACP than me. He's just, it's what he does.
Thanks. That was nice of you.
It's true.
It's not a perspective I had thought about. I was appalled by the many killing of black men by police. To me, that's outrageous. And it was time for me to do more than just say, ain't it awful? And that's what made me move forward with that. Because, you know, it's up to us white folks to help everybody understand how we all play a role in the current situation in this country. So that's what started it. But it makes me sad that in predominantly white America, African Americans and all people of color are seen as less than, and they have fewer opportunities than white folks have. They struggle more. There's that disparity that exists. And, you know, with the current administration, it's even worse. And my fear is that things will get worse before they get better. And what I'm trying to do is be more vocal to my white friends about helping them understand how we have all enjoyed our white privilege and examine that.
We'd like to thank Belinda and David for sharing their story with us. You can find out more about the Loving Project at our website, lovingproject.com. That's where you'll also find more episodes, links to follow us on social media, and pictures of some of the couples profiled on the show.
The Loving Project is available on iTunes, Google Play, NPR One, and just about anywhere else you find podcasts. And if you like the show, please consider leaving a review. It helps more people find out about the podcast. I'm Farrah Parks.
And I'm Brad Linder. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project.
In the next episode of The Loving Project, we'll hear from Joshu and Marlene.
Joshu is white and Marlene is black and Dominican. They've been together for 6 years, but after the returns came in on election night in 2016, Marlene briefly wondered how well she really knew her husband.
I was really, really, really distraught, and I hadn't slept. We had stayed up really late, so I wasn't in my right mind. But for a moment, I questioned who Joshu voted for, and I turned to him, and I said, did you vote for Trump? And so it was kind of a ridiculous question, and I realized that, but I was in tears when I asked him. I was so upset, I couldn't believe it, and in my mind, I kept asking, you know, what person that I thought wasn't going to vote for Trump voted for Trump, and am I married to that person?
It was statistically justified because a whole bunch of white people did vote for Trump, but I was probably the wrong person to suspect.
You were the first white person I saw that day.
Sure.
Marlene and Joshu's story, coming up next time on The Loving Project.